Hi, my name's Ali, and this is the Rus Files Unite podcast, where we watch Russian films and films with a Russian connection. As always, I'm joined by a guest, and today my guest is Tracy. Hi, Tracy.
Hello.
Thank you very much for joining me.
No problem.
So, before we talk about the film we're going to be watching today, could you tell the listeners a little bit about yourself?
Okay, I'm an English major. I'm from New York. My experience is mostly with British literature. I started actually getting more into Russian literature in the past year, but most people probably know me as a Jane Austen fan. That's really my primary interest and where a lot of my attention goes, but I try to spread my interest around a little bit. I'm, you know, into period drama in general, which is usually what people think of when they think of me. So, and that's probably what, you know, people would know me from if you asked them about what my interests are.
Sure. In fact, for the listeners, I was aware of Tracy first from her appearance on Falling in Love montage, where she's kind of their official Jane Austen correspondent at this point. yeah, so I'm a big Jane Austen fan myself, so I'm kind of predisposed to like anyone who thinks that Jane Austen is great. So, yes, very happy to have a fellow Jane fan or Miss Austen fan. I don't know how she would feel about me referring to her as Jane, as we're not acquainted. laughing at my own jokes, that always bodes well. But yeah, I specifically had you on for the film that we're watching today because it's as you mentioned, you're particularly a period drama fan. So let's talk about that a bit. What are your favorite period dramas?
Like I said, I am a Jane Austen fan. I love the 1995 Sense and Sensibility. That's probably my favorite movie. My favorite show is a little bit out of the way. It's a World War II drama called Home Fires. It unfortunately got canceled in the UK, but it's about a group of women in a village and how they deal with, you know, their sons, their husbands going off to war, and, you know, the work they do with the Women's Institute. It deals with a lot of things like illiteracy, domestic abuse, you know, a lot of these issues that happened on the home front. And it was, you know, very interesting, very emotional oftentimes with the way that it deals with the men going to war. But yeah, and recently last year was when I got into War and Peace because of the musical Natasha Pierre and the Great Comet of 1812, which was when I read the novel War and Peace. I also saw the musical about four times. And when I read the novel, I used to refer to it as living with War and Peace as I was working at it for several months. And I felt at the end like I knew these characters. So that also ended up becoming a favorite, actually.
Yeah, I mean, it's very cliched to call it an epic story, but just having a backdrop like the Napoleonic Wars is kind of like, it's just a massive canvas, and it's just really skillful how he weaves the personal stuff in with this huge thing going on behind over a number of years. Yeah, but it is, reading the thing is a bit of a slog and probably shouldn't be attempted to lightly. But
yeah,
what did you say the World War II drama was called? Home Fires?
Yes.
Yeah, that sounds really interesting. I totally missed that, but I'll want to check that out because I really enjoy World War II stuff, but it's nearly always about the men at the front, so it'd be cool to see the other side of it.
Yeah, my interest was always more the home front than the battles, so I tend to gravitate towards, you know, those sorts of stories. So that show came along and it was basically everything I had always been interested in. So it's a good one, but it sort of flew under the radar, which is sadly why it got cancelled.
Yeah. So slightly switching tack, changing tack, tacking something. have you seen any Russian movies?
I haven't. I don't think so. I've seen, I think, a bit of, like, German, Danish, but I can't recall. Oh, no, I have. There was one a couple years ago called Farewell. It was a Russian spy drama.
Oh, okay.
And I think that might be the only one that I'm familiar with. But it was something that came to the art cinema that I live near on Long Island. And it was, yeah, I think that's the only Russian I can remember. But other than that, the only things that are coming to mind are German.
Okay. Yeah. So, good to be introducing you to some stuff kind of outside your normal, like, I guess, stuff that you would watch, maybe.
Yeah.
So the thing that we're going to be watching today is called Sibirsky Tsirulnik, or the Barber of Siberia, is how it tends to be translated. And it's directed by Nikita Mikhalkov, who is kind of this huge figure of Russian cinema and acting. He's been around for a very long time. He was born in 1945, so I guess he's like 70-odd now. But he's Oscar-winning. He got an Oscar for Burnt by the Sun, which won in 1995. And he's been nominated for Best Foreign Language Picture several times outside of that, including 12, which was an adaptation or like Russian reworking of 12 Angry Men, and another one called Close to Eden. And this one, it's kind of funny, this one was going to be Russia's submission for the 1999 Oscars, but they got their application in slightly too late, so it was disqualified. So Russia had no submission that year because they didn't get their act together. Which, yeah, sometimes with Russian bureaucratic practices that I encountered when I was living in Moscow, that doesn't entirely surprise me. But yeah, it's I don't know very much about this at all, to be honest, going in. Had you heard of it before?
No, and I was a little surprised when I looked it up, since I know Richard Harris and Julia Ormond, and I wouldn't expect to see them in a Russian film. Just especially Richard Harris, knowing that he's British. And I know that there was a Ralph Fiennes movie, Ralph Fiennes, I think is actually how they say that, about 2 years ago, Two Women. And I know that they initially made this big deal out of him speaking Russian for the film. And then last year I found out that they ended up dubbing him over with a Russian actor because I guess him speaking Russian didn't go over so well.
Oh, I didn't know that. Yeah, that movie was on my radar of things to watch, but yeah, I haven't seen it. So I kind of think if I had seen it and not known that it was dubbed into Russian, I'd be like, wow, he's really good.
I thought that myself I put it on my list because I was like, wow, Ralph Fiennes speaking Russian, like this will be interesting. And then I found out they dubbed him over. I was like, oh, I guess that didn't happen.
It's like, but he doesn't even sound like him a bit.
Yeah.
Well, turns out there's a reason for that.
Yeah, I was sort of wondering how this is going to be with, you know, these actors that I predominantly know for speaking English, you know, in a Russian-speaking movie. I guess we'll find out, or they'll be speaking English, but...
Yeah, I think it's the latter, in that this... I could be totally wrong, so we'll find out, but I think certainly Julia Ormond's character is... I don't know, she may be American, in fact, but she's certainly not Russian, and I know that there's a fair, or at least I think I know, that a fair bit of the movie is in English, so it's kind of like a slightly unusual sort of crossover, two cultures meeting kind of movie. At least that's what, I guess, the hearsay, or what I think I've found out about watching the movie is, so... Yeah,
it will be interesting if most of the movie is in English. Since I live in New York, I had to get the a DVD that I could play on my DVD player, and the copy I got is all regions rather than, you know, just region one. And the DVD menu is quite Russian, as in I had a bit of a time figuring out how to even work it, as I couldn't read any of the menus. So I will be very happy if most of the film is in English, as the menu was decidedly not.
Yes, fun with Cyrillic.
Yeah, even the box was, you know, I turned it over, I was like, there is no English on this DVD box, and so...
So it's not like I can even read the blurb to find out what it...
Yeah, like, I sure hope they sent the right movie, but fortunately I know that is the case.
Yeah, like, what movie were you watching?
Yeah.
All right, I feel like we should probably go off and watch the film, but okay. As someone who's heard, like, one or two of these episodes before, you'll probably know what's coming. This is where I get to make you speak some Russian. So the phrase that we say is "Поехали." So 1, 2, 3.
Поехали.
Tracy and I have just watched The Barber of Siberia, and before we tell you what we thought, Tracy's just going to give us a quick summary of the plot, which might be a bit of a feat as it's nearly a 3-hour movie, but yes, condense away.
Yeah. So we start in 1905 in Massachusetts, and we have a woman writing a letter to her son, who's in the army, and we see her son in the army, and he's getting his hair trimmed, and there's a picture of Mozart up in the tent where they're getting their hair trimmed, and the commander is asking them why would they have a picture of Mozart up in the tent, and the one who's getting his hair trimmed sort of humiliates him by saying, oh, you know, Mozart was a composer, as if he didn't know. So he makes everyone put on their gas masks, which is apparently an anachronism, because IMDb says they didn't start using those until the First World War.
I did wonder about that, yes.
Yeah, until about, like, 10 years later, so bad. I was like, oh, that's interesting. So they put on their gas masks, and he's told that he can't take it off until he admits that, like, Mozart is a hack, and he won't do it, and that ends up being a thread throughout the rest of the film, is continually coming back, and he still hasn't taken off the gas mask, and he still won't admit that Mozart is a hack. But then we go to 1885 Russia, where the woman we saw writing the letter is getting off the train, and she's going to help McCracken, I think his name was.
Yep, that's the one.
Yeah, Richard Harris's character, who's trying to develop this steam engine that he calls the Barber of Siberia, because it will cut down all of the trees in Siberia much faster. And she is...
That's a lot of trees, after all.
Yeah. Maybe a very wealthy man, if he can get that working. And she's his daughter, and she's hoping to make a deal that with the general whose approval he needs to get the steam engine to go forward. But on the way in the train, she's met this young man named Tolstoy, who's a cadet in a specific regiment, and they hit it off. He breaks her fan and he wants to repair it for her, and they have a nice moment together. So it sort of ends up being a love triangle between this general that she's trying to seduce, her and Tolstoy, and the complications that arise from that.
Yeah, and that's the film. It's, yeah, fantastic compression there. Yeah, it's pretty epic. What did you think? Did you like it? Let's start off with that.
Yeah, it was different than what I was normally seeing, and I think because I'm used to either, you know, series that tend to be about, you know, especially with British series, tend to be about, like, maybe 6 hours long. And then you have movies that are usually, like, 2 hours long. So this was sort of, like, squarely in the middle of being around, like, 3 hours. So that sort of epic length was new to me, because I haven't, you know, I haven't watched many of, like, the older classic films that are that length. And then most of the modern ones that I've seen of that length, they're very, like, genre. Like, you've got your Lord of the Rings and those sorts of movies. So this was different for me to see a period epic, which I'm sure actually surprises a lot of people. But some of the filmmaking, like the strange close-ups, were a little bit much for me. But overall, I thought it was definitely interesting and not something I was used to seeing.
Interesting is always good. I mean, I was really impressed by the production values. Like, I've written down here words like lavish and sumptuous and opulent and splendor and all that sort of thing. It's a very nice film to look at.
Yeah, my mother and I always wonder sometimes when, you know, she'll sit down and watch one of these things with me, when you look at the houses that they have to get, and then, you know, things like the old trains, you know, and vehicles that they need, and, you know, especially set pieces like the fair that they go to, it must take an incredible amount of time to design a lot of this period detail, not to mention the costumes.
Yeah, and especially this is made in probably like 19, I think it came out in 98, so it would be made, you know, 96, 97. You can't just CGI a nice crowd scene.
Yeah.
It's kind of like if you want that scale, you have to, you know, corral all of these extras and have all the costumes and all that stuff. It's more of an undertaking, I guess.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the things with older movies, just always impresses me, like the lengths that you had to go to achieve some of those effects. I mean, not wishing to, you know, downplay the immense amount of skill it takes with a computer to make that stuff look real. But yeah, there's something about having to do things in real life, as it were.
Yeah.
It always impresses me.
Staying on the topic of Russian film, I haven't seen it yet, but since I mentioned having read War and Peace last year, I was looking into watching the actual Russian film version that was done by, I think, Sergei Bondarchuk is the name?
Yeah, Bondarchuk.
Yeah, and I know that it's another that's definitely like 3 or 4 hours, and I know that they actually had to obviously have actual, you know, extras for the battle scenes, and just reading about the sheer number of extras and the amount of work it must have taken is incredible, and it's no wonder that the film took, I think, several years to get made. But
yeah. Do you know what? I may be mistaken about this, and, you know, someone can write in and correct me, but I think it may even be 6 or 7 hours. Like, it's, you know...
It is entirely possible.
Yeah. I mean, there is a lot of story.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, with War and Peace, it's a bit like Lord of the Rings. It's not that you don't have enough material. It's just like, how do you cut it down in such a way? So you said it's kind of been a surprise that it's slightly different in terms of just length for this genre of film.
Yeah.
Was there anything else that kind of struck you as, like, not what you expected going in?
I think just some of the humor of it was very interesting to me, because people have this idea that, you know, period dramas are so staid and repressed that, you know, I found it really delightful. There's this whole bit about the cadets are waxing the floors for this ballroom, and just in the beginning when they're looking at the wax and they're reading off the label and it says, like, wax surprise for, like, these elegant balls, and then it becomes this whole plot point that they've, you know, waxed the floors so brilliantly and everybody is, you know, slipping and sliding like it was a skating rink, and, you know, that's not something...
Yeah, someone calls it a skating rink at one point.
Yeah, and it's just not something you're used to, you know, seeing or thinking about when it comes to these productions, so that was definitely a very welcome surprise, was that it could be very lighthearted in parts, which was good, because it gets more serious later on. But...
Oh, it gets very heavy, but yeah. I mean, the first, I would say almost, like, hour plus... The tone is primarily comic. I mean, you do have a terrorist attack.
Yeah.
You know, which...
That was a surprise, yeah.
Yeah, because it has been so comic until, like, I guess the terrorist attack is, what, like 15, 20 minutes in?
Yeah.
If memory serves. And, yeah, that comes kind of out of nowhere. I mean, you see that it's going to happen just before it happens. You see some people doing some suspicious stuff. And you're like, oh, something is afoot here. But yeah, and then it goes back to being kind of ridiculous and comical. But yeah, then it gets into some really heavy stuff. I'm sorry, I had no idea that was coming up. So yeah, people should be aware that, like, rape slash...
Yeah, child grooming was a plot aspect that I was sort of not expecting, and when it showed up, thankfully it was just, you know, mentioned, but I was like, wow, that's quite horrifying, so...
Yeah, and you find that the underneath Julia Ormond's character, Jane's, you know, well, it turns out to be facade of, you know, extreme confidence and self-assuredness, she kind of hates herself because of what's happened to her, and that's really upsetting.
Yeah, I sort of wondered, because in the beginning when they joined her in her train car, I was almost wondering if she was, you know, a courtesan or something, and I said to myself, oh, she's not, and then as it turned out, yes, she sort of was, and, you know, had unfortunately been, you know, used as, you know, not really sex work, but, you know, had been abused by her stepfather in her past, and it was just this very, you know, deeply sad revelation, especially watching, you know, the way in which it affects her to have opened up to someone about that. And you know, it was definitely extremely well acted, especially the scene where she confesses to him was really, really something.
Yeah, it was very affecting. I wrote it down, but I don't know if I've got it exactly perfect, but she says something which might sound a bit trite just out of context, but she says something like, no one ever had
any use for my heart.
For my
heart. I wrote that down as well.
Yeah, and it's like, oh my goodness. Doesn't make you feel very good about males in general.
Yeah,
that somebody could have got to be, you know, in their mid-20s and just think like, yep, half of the species just awful.
Yeah.
And not to be trusted. But, yeah. Which, you know, if something like that happens to you, it's not really surprising. But, so that's something to be aware of.
I think I was also glad that the film was very kind to her almost in that regard, because she has this moment where, because of what she's been through, she expects Tolstoy to just want sex from her, and she goes and sits on his bed and presumably, you know, undresses some. She's able to get redressed fairly quickly, so I assume she wasn't entirely naked, but you don't even see any of that. It's just she's positioned just off camera, and all you see is Tolstoy's face as he looks at her. And
you hear kind of shuffling noises, and it's kind of like, is she undressing? Is that what's going on? And then she says, is this your bed? And you're kind of like, oh, right, yes, that is what she's doing. Yeah.
And it was just so interesting to me the way the film just completely sidestepped that nudity. And it gives some of the power to her in a way by focusing, you know, it's sort of male gaze, but it's not male gaze in the way that we're looking at her body. It's we're looking at him looking at her. And I just thought that was very interesting because, you know, I'm used to seeing American films where, you know, the nudity would just be on full display, especially if it's female nudity as opposed to male nudity, which you don't see as much. So that was also very interesting.
Well, and to be fair, non-English language films have a bit of a reputation. You know, if you say, oh, it's a European art house film, you go, oh, right, so there are boobs.
Yeah, and even when I was in the West End, when I was a teenager, I saw Cabaret on stage, and the very stark difference between Cabaret on stage and when I later saw it on Broadway was, yes, there were performers that were fully nude at several points.
You're using the word stark advisedly.
It was very different, and of course, when I saw it on Broadway, I was like, oh, this is not the fully nude production that I sometimes saw when I was in the West End.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Yes. I'd heard that Cabaret, on stage these days is not what it is in the film. Not that I've seen the film, but yes, I can't imagine like a 1971 film of Cabaret is going to be like, here is all of everyone. But yes. Yeah, I totally take your point. It is kind to her in that moment. And I kind of felt like, I don't know, maybe this is having watched it in two sittings, but I feel like the film's better that first couple of hours, and it kind of loses its way a bit towards the end.
Yeah, I definitely felt like the pacing was a little bit odd, because you spend so much time in that build-up to the action of, you know, what happens to Tolstoy that eventually, you know, gets him banned and sent away. And then after he's sent away, it's sort of crammed into, I think, only about a half an hour.
Yeah.
Of, you know, what really happens. And I was like, that was an awful lot of build-up towards, you know, like a very, like, big inciting incident that we're told is going to, like, shape the plot. And then it's just, you know, and things that you would think would be dwelt on a little bit more really aren't. And so that was definitely something that probably could have been smoothed out a bit more.
What did you think of the portrayal of Russians as people and Russia as a place.
I was actually very surprised that the film is fairly critical of Russia, especially sort of the Russian military establishment through Jane, because her focus in writing to this this boy that we find out is her son by Tolstoy, rather than her son by McCracken, is just very, you know, wanting him to avoid, you know, these missteps that the Russian military made. And, you know, overall we see that they're fairly human in treating, you know, the cadets as, you know, boys. They get to, you know, have fun. They have this performance of, you know, the Marriage of Figaro. But, you know, they still, there's always this risk of, you know, court-martial. They avoid it once after they've had a duel, but of course it ends up, you know, being a reality for him when he makes an assassination attempt, a very ill-advised one. But I was very surprised that they were very frequently having her voice concerns that she says at one point, can it be true that human life means nothing in this country? And that really stood out to me because it seemed very sharply critical, which is not something I would expect from a film actually made in that country.
And the retort is something like, it depends on whose life it is, which is...
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, which I felt like that was one of several different instances where the filmmakers were kind of saying, yeah, we know this is sort of how we're perceived.
Yeah. And I think that comes through in the depiction of the military too, especially in a scene where the czar is speaking to the gathered cadets and he's saying, you know, the Russian soldier is brave, upstanding, and patient, and that's why he's invincible. And you just get this very, you know, clear sense of what they're trying to instill in these boys, and I thought that was very interesting.
Yeah.
Especially because you also have the presence of a child character that, you know, his wife, it's later said that it's his nephew, it's not his son, and but his wife is very critical of the fact that he's having a young child at these proceedings, being exposed to this, you know, not even military action, but just the presence of the military and what that stands for. And you can tell that she's very uneasy about that and would rather that a child not be exposed to that, whereas the men sort of think nothing of it. And I also found that very interesting.
Yeah, well, there's a really quite shocking line there that the Tsar says to the to his wife. He says something like, well, if I'd listened to you, we wouldn't have any children anyway.
Yeah, and that's sort of like presented almost like as a throwaway or a joke, but like it's actually very cruel, and that was also very surprising.
The implication being like, you have never consented to to sleeping with me, and it's like, oh gosh. Incidentally, did you realize that the Tsar was played by the director Nikita Mikhalkov?
I had read that in believe in IMDb, and I thought that was very interesting. And I know you said in the prior film in Malcolm's episode he was also a lead actor, so I knew that he was an actor.
Yeah. He was Sir Henry Baskerville. Yeah. Yes. This much more of a cameo appearance, and it's difficult to read what his portrayal, not what his portrayal, but what he's getting at with the characterization, because on the one hand he's this kind of strict disciplinarian guy, but he's, you know, about having these really strong upstanding values, but he's cruel and cold to his wife. And, you know, I don't know whether that joke is meant to be like ha ha funny or like ugh, that's gross.
Yeah,
you know, 'cause it's totally deadpan played. And I mean, the real Tsar Alexander III was not a very nice guy. He was very kind of, as the film suggests, tough and uncompromising and militaristic. I mean, you know, his own father had been blown up by anarchist terrorists, so that kind of partly explains why he cracked down.
Yeah.
And as we see in this film, it was not necessarily a, you know, I don't know how to put this. That was something you had to consider all the time as the ruling family of Russia at that point, was that, yeah, that there were people out there who were trying to kill you.
Yeah.
Was this, doesn't necessarily make for good decision making, or
yeah, was this before the Romanovs, or I think it was before.
Yeah, this is Alexander is Nicholas II's dad. So he's the second from last Tsar.
Yeah.
And the picking of 1905 for some of the other, well, the kind of the setup and, you know, the returning scenes is quite a significant one, as that's when Russia had its pre-revolution, the revolution it didn't take. Yeah, so I wondered whether they set it in 1905 rather than, you know, 1904 or 1906 as a kind of like a marker of, you know, stuff was afoot, even though they don't depict anything from that.
Yeah, I would definitely imagine so. Usually when they pick these things, it's very deliberate. It's something that just comes to mind because recently I was at a screening of Call Me By Your Name where they spoke to the author of the book that the film was based on, and he spoke for quite some time about how he had set the book in a more like amorphous 80s period, but the movie was very specific about the year in the 80s it picked because they wanted to capture a very specific political time in Italy, and that sounds very similar to what you're saying of what they may have been aiming at here. So
yeah, just kind of like implying that in the background or whatever.
Yeah.
I in terms of the depiction of Russia, sometimes I found that it was a bit overly playing into the stereotypes, which is kind of like you'd expect it if it was being made by a Western film, but there were certain things that were a bit kind of seemed a bit kitschy to me.
Yeah, I think especially the character going on a bender at one point, which I think it's called a zapoy, when it's just
which is a Russian word I didn't actually know, and I feel ashamed for not knowing this, as I feel like it's a word I should be aware of.
But, just the vodka, you know, bender, and then especially it's funny because having read War and Peace, there were certain things they mention a policeman being tied to a chair at one point, and in the beginning of War and Peace, there's actually a policeman tied to a bear, and I have my notes like, oh, if only they had said a policeman tied to a bear. But there were definitely things that were sort of echoes that I recognized from the other, you know, Russian things that I had been exposed to. So that's definitely, you know, interesting that they were sort of playing into those stereotypes.
Yeah, and a lot of Russia's most famous literature is from roughly that time period. And initially, when they mentioned that the main male character's name was Tolstoy, I was kind of like, I was rolling my eyes. I was like, really, really? But then they make that joke like three or four times throughout the runtime, like the author. Yes, like the author.
No relation, you know. So.
Yeah, different iterations of that joke. So it's kind of like they realized that they were making a cheesy choice, but they at least, you know, acknowledge it and don't pretend like it's, oh, we just picked this. It's just a common Russian name, you know.
Yeah, they committed to the choice that they made.
Yeah, and which is good.
It's sort of especially interesting considering you were saying that, you know, it almost made it as the representative film for the entire country in the Academy Awards, that to think that instead of something that, you know, maybe presented a more, like, nuanced view, it almost played into the very broad stereotypes that we would expect.
Yeah, it is kind of weird, and as you say, it was slightly more, in some regards, more critical of Russia as a place than you might expect, you know, now in the, you know, the Putin era. Then again, if you've seen Leviathan,
that's on my list. I did hear about that when it was in the cinema here, so I'll have to check it out.
And we've covered Loveless by the same director on this podcast, and that's not exactly painting a particularly rosy picture. So, you know, they don't mind showing the place in not the most positive of lights, which I suspect happened a lot less during Soviet times.
But
what did you think of the? We've talked a bit about Mikhalkov and his very short appearance, but in terms of the other performances, how did you feel about those?
As I said, I was very impressed with Julia Ormond. I'm familiar with her from other films, but not, you know, too many. I think some other period work that she's done and other things here and there. The young man that played Tolstoy was sometimes a little bit, you know, exaggerated, but I think it really sort of worked for him. But Julia Ormond was definitely the standout for me. There was a scene in particular that I found really affecting where after Andre is has been arrested for the assassination attempt that he makes on the general that's been, you know, vying for her affections, even though she's been quite clear to him that it's a charade and it's, you know, something that she's doing to get the job done that she needs to have done. She goes to his mother in particular and is, you know, begging her to write to the czar, I believe, to get, you know, sort of, if not like a stay of execution, just to hope that they would be more lenient in the sentencing. And the mother, of course, has no idea who she is because, you know, her son has sort of been, you know, consorting with her by, you know, going out with her and sort of seeing her more or less in secret and in her own quarters. And she basically just says to her, you know, who are you? And Jane realizes that she has no claim that she can really explicate on Andre. And she ends up having to say that she's no one and to sort of, you know, back away. And just the look on her face and some of the acting she was doing in that moment was incredibly heartbreaking. And it's just I feel like it's a very hard moment to play without exaggerating it too much, and I felt that Julia Ormond did a really great job with that.
And it's kind of a doubling of that scene, because just before that she's gone to, I think it's to the prison or the prison barracks or something like that, and has had a very similar conversation with the guard.
Yeah.
And it's almost like you kind of think, oh, that's a bit repetitive. Is that not redundant? But it's kind of like, I don't know, it just hammers it home further when she does it with this stranger to doing it, having that conversation with Andre's mother. As you say, it's really well done. And I just really, I love her poise at the beginning when she just has this carriage full of really boisterous Russian soldiers. And she doesn't, you know, she has a few words of Russian at that time, but she's not, if she's intimidated at all, she doesn't show it, because she's just totally in command of that situation. And yeah, you can definitely see why Andre takes a shine to her, because yeah, she's just incredibly like winsome and impressive.
Yeah, especially because we later learn that she does have such reason to fear and mistrust men. The fact that she's so in command of a group of several of them who are quite drunk is very, you know, very impressive. Yeah. And just, you know, it speaks to how, you know, capable of an actress she is, that you see that she's been hired at all to do this, you know, deal that needs to go forward for McCracken. And, you know, just learning sort of the depth of the way that she's had to deceive everyone puts, you know, a lot of the things you see early in the film in a very different light, and it just makes her really fascinating to watch.
Yeah, it's a shame she's not in more recently. I was just going through IMDb listings, and it seems like in the, I guess, the 90s was sort of her film like heyday, but I guess that's just, you know, the dynamics of Hollywood casting, etc., etc. Now that she's no longer like a gorgeous 20/early 30 something. Yeah, I'd definitely like to see her in more stuff. I think that's kind of it as far as the performance-y stuff.
Yeah.
Was there anything else that you wanted to bring up?
I think the one thing I thought was very interesting was I had to look up The Marriage of Figaro because I wasn't very familiar with it. But in looking it up, I found that it was a continuation of The Barber of Seville, which, having mentioned this movie to my mother, she asked me what the name of it was. And I said, you know, are you thinking of The Barber of Seville? Because that's what I was thinking of, too. And she said, yes. And I realized, you know, in seeing that they were, you know, using a specific piece that was a follow on to The Barber of Seville, that they were obviously being very deliberate in their references, you know, in making, you know, the pun of the Barber of Siberia for this machine that's going to cut down trees versus, you know, this opera that's a continuation of the Barber of Seville. So I thought that was very interesting. I'm always sort of interested in the intertextuality of how these things, you know, come up and are played with. So that was definitely a very interesting recurring theme, as well as, you know, the apparently the plot of The Marriage of Figaro revolves around this man that's in power feeling that he has the right to sleep with, you know, a servant woman that, you know, is working under his estate. So just thinking, and they sort of quote a line or two that really brings that to the forefront, that it's this powerful man that feels that he has a right to this woman, which is obviously the position that Jane is in, having to seduce the general. So I thought that the way that they used that as an intertext was very interesting as well.
Oh, that's cool, because I noticed that they mentioned very briefly the Barber of Seville very early on. But yeah, I wasn't aware of that kind of linking of the plot lines. I thought the general was an interesting character, actually, because for a while I felt kind of sorry for him, just in the sense of, like, you know, he is very powerful and important, but you feel sorry for somebody just being a bit clueless and not just, you know, maybe you should be interested in someone a bit closer to your age, perhaps.
Yeah.
which, you know, sorry, is very judgmental on my part, but it's kind of like just the you know, initially anyway, it doesn't read as this sort of very confident, well, of course she would love me. He's quite tentative, but it's only when he realizes that, you know, he has a rival that he just totally loses it. I also feel sorry for him with the alcoholism thing, because clearly he tries to say no to Jane, kind of like trying to push alcohol on him, and he's just like, no, you know, please don't. And he's trying to get out of it, but it's too polite to say, you know, just flat out, seriously, I have a problem, don't try and make me drink. Because that's a, you know, super embarrassing position to be in. And then, yeah, once he's had one, it's the, you know, the classic, you know, he's now on a bender, or a zapoy, as we learnt.
Especially because it's played so much for comedy, when really, like, falling off the wagon is actually quite serious.
It's,
you know,
horrible. Yeah. I didn't know how to feel about that, actually. Yeah. Because it is funny, but yeah, when you think about the real life implications, And the bit where he stuffs the glass into his mouth, and you're like, you're going to hurt yourself. This is horrible.
I felt the same about the cadets, you know, smashing all the glasses after they've, you know, had the drink at the assembly. And it was, you know, I knew that was a thing in Russia, but, you know, just seeing the sheer number of people throwing their glasses to the ground, I was like, oh, that must be so, like, dangerous and horrible.
Yeah. That's going to be really fun for somebody to clear up. Yeah, I wasn't even aware particularly of that being a tradition. It may be something that's just kind of older, or just not the people I was hanging out with when I was out there. Some of the stuff with the cadets, I've just written this down as like a placeholder, because I haven't even seen this movie, but Animal House, just. Which I haven't seen, I just kind of know the reputation, but the cadets do get up to a lot of crazy antics, let's call them.
Yeah, I was even just surprised at sort of the amount of things that they were doing, especially the marriage of Figaro, because I'm coming from, you know, a Jane Austen background, this is obviously about, you know, 70, 80 years later than what she was depicting, but there's such a strong component in Mansfield Park in particular that acting is sort of frowned upon as immoral. And so to see that the men are, you know, encouraged not only to act, but to cross-dress, it was very interesting to me, and that they're, you know, in this sort of very, you know, what would be probably considered a feminine, you know, artistic pursuit is, you know, singing opera. And to see that that was encouraged and, you know, looked forward to and visited by dignitaries was very interesting to me.
Yeah, it's quite surprising. I mean, I don't really know very much about theatre in general, and, you know, Russian theatre in particular, but I think I heard that in the 1870s and 80s that in a lot of, you know, important provincial towns, they started having their own theatres, and that theatre was really kind of taking off as a form of entertainment, you know, across Russia at that point. I think there had been theatre before, but I think it was more concentrated in the two capitals, Moscow and St. Petersburg. So it may just be a reflection of that.
Yeah, and I know that they were in Moscow at least, so it was definitely, you know, some place where they were that would make sense, that was something that they would be doing.
Yeah, speaking of the setting, that was, it definitely had as somebody who's lived there, a slightly travelogue-y feel. You know, I was just kind of noting down the places. I mean, obviously they do the Kremlin quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
There's one thing that looks slightly dodgy, actually. They have the Cathedral of Christ the Saviour, which was actually built in the Victorian era, but was blown up by the Soviets. Mm-hmm. And I was trying to work out whether it had been fully rebuilt by that point, because the few shots they have of it looked a bit like it was a matte painting or something. It just didn't look quite photo real.
Yeah. And,
but I was also scrutinizing it harder, because I was kind of like, this was made at a time when I don't know whether they'd finished rebuilding it, so I was looking at it more carefully than I would have been. But yes, that's kind of a very nerdy little detail. But they also have Novodevichy Monastery, which is, you know, quite a famous landmark. I think that's in the background for the Maslenitsa, or the it's kind of like Russian Mardi Gras sequences. And there's another one which really stood out to me, because I used to live near there. They go past the Church of the Ascension, which is this kind of odd looking, quite angular church that they pass by, I think on a sledge, but it is kind of all of the famous landmarks almost in Moscow. So in that regard, it's, you know, it falls prey slightly to the, sometimes when films are set in a very specific place, you kind of feel like you have to hit all of those landmarks to go, look, and now it's here. So
yeah. And especially when there was such an, you know, an early emphasis on, you know, the train pulling out into the snow, I'm thinking of, you know, like all of the Russian literature that I've been exposed to. You know, there's always trains and there's always snow, and I was like, you know, this is sort of like exactly what I expect.
Yeah, and they had quite a nice shot of her looking out of the train window into the forest, but you're also getting her reflection in the window at the same time, which is kind of like, it's very showy and it's very stylized, but I did quite like that just as an image. That's something I feel like that will stay with me.
It was really a beautiful shot, and they really lingered on it and took their time with it, and I think it's a very interesting introduction to her character.
Yeah, because it sort of gives you this sense of her reflecting on the place that she's in, but also on herself and her place in this place, I guess.
And really the role that she's meant to play, because something that had caught at me really early on was when she gets off the train and she, you know, meets with Richard Harris, is she's really going through this, you know, performance, and he asks about, you know, her husband, and she tells this, you know, story of saying like, oh, he, you know, he passed, didn't I write to you, you know, yes, he was eaten by crocodiles, and, you know, all that was left of his was his bow tie. And it's this very, you know, exaggerated story, and I said to myself, you know, of course, you know, she's playing it off, she's making it a joke. And later she says to the general that, you know, oh, he died with Custer at Little Bighorn. And I said to myself, you know, obviously there's two different stories there, is, you know, saying, oh, he died at Little Bighorn, another lie. And then you realize, when, you know, you have the full context, that she's someone that's been hired to play this part and do this job, that she was, you know, really just coming up with an act at the train station for the benefit of this person there that she didn't know, and, you know, was really trying to, you know, put on that act to sell it and make it believable. And I thought that was really interesting, that there are some moments with her that, when you then have the retrospect of knowing who she is and what she's been through, just become really, you know, interesting to look at again.
Yeah, it's almost, it's not quite this level, but it is almost the Joker's in The Dark Knight. Yeah, do you want to know how I got these scars?
Yeah.
How did my husband die? Well,
I was almost waiting for there to be like another variation that she told Alexei.
So. Yeah, I wouldn't have been surprised if it had come up, because this film isn't, it certainly isn't one to, you know, hold back on really selling a joke. Okay, cool. I think we've covered this film like in quite a bit of detail. Would you recommend this to other people who wouldn't normally go in for Russian films, do you think?
I think I would certainly recommend it to the people. I obviously have, quite a few fans in the period drama sort of niche, and I think I would recommend it because, to people that are sort of looking for that sort of film in general, because until you told me that you were thinking of, this film for the episode, I hadn't even heard of it, which really surprised me considering, the two people in it that I knew. And I think it's so, out of the way, and it does have its flaws. The pacing could have been better, but it's just different, and I think it's worth, experiencing at least once just to, see a Russian film made in Russia. And I think that's sort of, out of the way, especially because period drama tends to focus so much on the English that I think that this would be worth experiencing to someone that's looking for something different, especially something about Russia, because the Russian stuff that I'm used to is, more Napoleonic Wars, or in the case of like Dr. Zhivago is more towards like World War I. So this is sort of, in a different period than you're used to seeing, and I think a different perspective than you're used to seeing. So I think anyone that's willing to try it, I think would probably find something of value in it.
Yeah, it is refreshing for it to be like a period piece that is non-literary adaptation.
Yeah, no, those are very rare. You would think that they're not, but reflecting on the ones that I've seen, they are by and large, adaptations. So.
I guess a lot of that is just the kind of green lighting and, what do you think you can get people to turn up and see? Because it was like, oh yeah, Anna Karenina, I have heard of that. I'll
Yeah.
go along and see
It
it.
really tends to be a lot of adaptations and biopics, really, is the by and large the majority of the field. So getting an original made is very difficult and always, something that really should be supported and encouraged.
Yeah. I mean, even if it does turn out being like slightly overwrought in places, which this is.
Yeah.
I mean, the other thing that I found quite refreshing, and I've not really seen very much of this, is a film that's almost like a 50-50 split in terms of the language. It's normally you get it's more like 90-10 or something like that. Like if you think of something like Lost in Translation, it's mostly in English with incidental Japanese kind of around, but it's you don't have much in the way of people conversing with each other.
Yeah, or some films you even just have, 100%, you don't really hear a lot of English. I'm thinking on some of the ones that I've seen in recent years, and I can't really recall many that had, a lot of English. So there's, you've either got like a 90-10 or you've just got a 100%, completely in the other language. So, because why would they have any reason to speak English when they're in their home country? So it's just, it was definitely interesting to see a film that was, by and large in English, but also with, the cadets tended to be speaking Russian amongst themselves. So.
Yeah, although sometimes it was a bit weird they'd be speaking to each other in English. I thought I was slightly suspicious of the extent to which English was spoken well in Russia at that time. I was like,
Yeah.
yeah, I don't buy this, because even by the time I got to live in Moscow, lots of people did speak it very well, but it was very easy to run into somebody who didn't at all. So,
Yeah.
and even the general Radloff, who says, "I'm bad at this, I need a translator," really kind of doesn't.
Yeah.
So yeah,
And
I thought that was a bit of a stretch, but
especially because, for me, my main focal point, because it's the longest work I've been exposed to, is War and Peace, where it, tends to just be, yes, I read it in translation, but, presumably the characters are speaking Russian or they're speaking French. And, there's something like I believe 2% of the entire book is in French. And, you have that aspect of it. And so, but it's not like they were speaking English, at that time. It was either, one or the other. So I can, and having been in Montreal, where there was English, but it was also by and large French, I can believe what you're saying, that, there are countries where you go there and you just find people that don't speak English whatsoever, or if they do, they don't speak it terribly well. So.
Yeah, I mean, one of the this is kind of an aside, but the funny thing was, and my Russian to this day is by no means fantastic and getting rustier by the day, but you had to it was very difficult to convince somebody that that your Russian was actually better than their English, because they would just assume, no, there's no way that you could have learned. And it's not everyone, but just if you did bump into somebody and they would be speaking to you in very tortuous English, you know, I would say, you know, I do actually speak Russian, and they would still like persist sometimes. It was quite frustrating, but yeah, never mind. It was also interesting seeing a film that was kind of aimed at two national audiences. Well, not even two national audiences, but it was aimed at a Russian audience whilst also being aimed at a Western audience at the same time, I felt. Like, it wasn't being made purely for one or the other, and kind of like, well, you know, if people in the other place like it, then that's fine, but we don't really care. So that was quite interesting.
Yeah, especially the, you know, the American side story, which really doesn't come to much other than being, you know, a framing story for the film. But I think you can tell that that's definitely, you know, there for a reason, especially because it opens the film that, you know, I think it's to sort of, you know, ground the audience in, you know, something that they're familiar with before putting them into something that they're probably not.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't mind the framing device so much, but they leaned on it a bit more than they needed to in the end point. Like, you have a voiceover, this is getting into massive spoiler territory, where Jane, you know, goes to see if she can locate Andre in, you know, after his exile, you know, his many years of exile in Siberia. It just then spells out all the way that she's feeling, and I'm kind of like, I don't know, this snob in me is like, no, she's a good enough actor that you can see these things in her face, and you can show that. You do not have to spell it out for me with this silly voiceover.
Especially when you've trusted her with such weighty emotional material earlier in the film, and she's proven that she can handle it. It was sort of, you know, that they drew back at the last second and weren't sure and decided to add in this voiceover.
Yeah, so it's not like, oh, crap, the performances that we've got on tape aren't sufficiently compelling that we now have to kind of, or just thinking the audience is probably going to be dumb, so we you know, that's kind of slightly how it felt. Like,
maybe they won't get it, even though they already have had the voiceover like explicating most of the plot so far.
So maybe that I feel like that's done less these days, and it might just be a function of this being like a
It's already almost 20 years old, so I think that that's definitely part of it.
So you definitely say you'd recommend it to other period drama fans, but personally, does this make you want to watch other films by this guy, by Mikhalkov?
Yeah, I would definitely be interested in seeing more of his work. This was interesting. I think I'd maybe like to see something a little bit shorter, but if all of his work is like this, I would certainly be interested in seeking it out and seeing what else that he's done, because sometimes, you know, when people make a period drama, it's, you know, just a one-off for them, and, you know, their other films are very different. So I think I would be interested in seeing, you know, if what he did was more along these lines, or if he did something, you know, completely different and this was just like an experiment for him, as it sometimes is for some people.
I've only seen one of his other things, and that's the one that he won the best foreign language film for, Burnt by the Sun, and that's definitely worth looking out for. Definitely would recommend that. It's also technically a period setting, as it's 1930s, but it's not, you know, period setting with a capital P, which tends to be like, you know, Victorian or Regency is what that tends to read.
Yeah. There's always debate in the period drama fandom of, you know, I think right now the cutoff tends to be like the 50s or the 60s, depending on who you ask. But I'm really up for anything whenever I watch these.
Do women still wear corsets? If no, this is no longer a period film. I don't know whether that's really how it's done.
Oh, discussions get like very acrimonious very quickly.
Okay, well, I will step. I'll step out of that. Dangerous water, as you say. All right. So, Before you go, Tracy, is there anything that you'd like to direct listeners towards in terms of other things you've done that are out there on the internet?
I do have a very infrequently updated reviewing blog that I for books that I read that I've tried to get off the ground again in recent years. That's I'll give you the link to put in the show notes, but that's pleasureinagoodnovel.blogspot.com, I believe, is the link on that. And as you mentioned, I was on Falling in Love Montage. I did the entirety of their Emma episode as a guest, and then I was on the Clueless episode briefly for about 10 or 15 minutes at the end. And I've also been on assorted other podcasts. It's a lot to list, but yeah, it was definitely a lot of fun, and thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's been great. Yeah, any time. Definitely have to have you back for, you know, maybe further period dramas or maybe do something else. Yeah, yeah. Awesome. Well, thanks very much again. And that's all for today. Das Vidanya, folks.
Thank you.
Hello again. I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Rooster Files Unite podcast. If you'd like to get in touch, I'd love to hear from you. So, there's a couple of different ways you can do that. There's a Rooster Files Unite Facebook group you can join. We're on Twitter, at Rooster Files U. That's Rooster Files with the letter U at the end. We're on Instagram, at Rooster Files _Unite. And you can also email at roosterfilesunite@gmail.com. Also, if you can spare a couple of minutes to rate us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts, that will help other people hear about the show and would be very much appreciated. Thanks again for listening, and goodbye.